cholesterol was extracted from carrots. How it came about. There's a lot of stuff that was done in the 20s and 30s, and then it was, Richard Williams of RCA found that liquid crystals had some interesting electro-optical characteristics and realized an electro-optical effect by generating a strike pattern of thin layers of liquid crystal material on the application of a voltage. Effect is based on an electro-hydrodynamic instability forming what is now called Williams domain inside of a crystal. Okay, then they went on to discover that the switching of colors could be created by realignment of dichroic dyes in a homeotropically oriented liquid crystal. How you get your colors displayed. Practical problems, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, that's the basic idea. And they, yeah, the first ones were called dynamic scattering modes, just what I said at the beginning. They first displayed like that. And, you know, the actual composition is a cyanobiphenyl liquid crystal, which has a good stability of temperature and good properties for LCD. And there's some more patents, and, you know, as time goes on, it gets better and better. King 2 RWK, you're dead.
Yeah, at flea markets, you and I have seen a number of handheld calculators where somebody had left them outside in a minus 20 degree weather, and the display became permanently damaged. But now when it comes to large screen display devices, 30, 40, and 50, and 60 inch wide television screens these days, now we've got to compromise with how high is the resolution of the individual pixels, how pure is the color, what's the bright-dark ratio it can produce. Are liquid crystal displays the most popular kind of television screens these days? Do they have a little bit of a latency problem where they're a little slow to respond so that as far as displaying the movie Grand Prix, some of the scenes will become smeared because of a particular television screen display can't quite keep up? So when it comes to state-of-the-art television-like displays in our homes these days, is liquid crystal the state-of-the-art, Eric? Plasma at one time sounded awful good, but I think people are not so... Let me drop it. I think they're not so enthusiastic about plasma displays these days, but of the reasonably high-quality, not too super expensive television screens I can buy today, is liquid crystal or some other variant what I should be seeking from what you know, Eric, because you're in that business? KE2EJ, K2IW, the TechNet.
K2RW, K2J. Now, the prices of OLEDs, or organic LEDs, is coming down, and that ultimately gives you the best bang for your image. It gives you the highest contrast ratio between black and white. And it doesn't have the problems of a liquid crystal in terms of its slowness. So when you go buy a screen that's a liquid crystal screen, you want a refresh rate of something 240 hertz or higher. The actual refresh rate that is required to display the picture and allow for decay time between them, that you don't see a smearing from the display itself. You'll see other artifacts that look like smearing that actually aren't from the display. It's from the compression scheme being used to transmit the video. Really need something that's 120 frames per second if you want to allow for the decay time of the crystal to go back to it, to change its state and, you know, completely arrive at the next state. But don't forget, we're only changing them during the blanking period or the refresh period of the picture, which may, in HD, is only 15 milliseconds long, which is not a lot of time.
Okay, so liquid crystal display is okay. OLED, organic LED display, sounds like it's close to the best, and is capable of giving you much greater than a 240 hertz refresh rate. Are the OLEDs a little more pricey than it sounds like they would have to be? Are 10% or 90% of the good television sets I can buy these days OLED? And is that the best one coming over the horizon that you hear about these days on large screen, thin panel type displays, Eric? So if I'm buying another television set for the next 10 years of my life, the way I do things, I buy something for 10 years and leave it. I don't keep updating every year, if you know. time. The rig you're listening to now, a Kenwood 711A, your old mode rig. I think it's 1985, 1990 vintage, an oldie but goodie. So I don't have to have the latest and greatest. This one's something that works well, reliable, and gives me the functions I need. So, is OLED what I should I seek? Are they 30% more expensive? And is there something better? In other words, should I wait for the better one that's coming right around the corner? Or is OLED right now the best I can get with moderately large screen television displays in my living room? KE2EJ, K2LAW, and the TechNet. Back to our broadcast engineer. You got it, Eric.
Now, I consider this K2LAW, K2EJ. With an LCD or liquid crystal display, it requires a light source behind the display in order for you to see something with your eyeball. An OLED display, each pixel is an LED, so it's an additive process. It generates, each pixel generates its own light. You're not relying on some multispectral light behind it to try and reproduce the image that, you know, conforms to the CCIR curve that's actually coming out of the cameras, so that you actually get to see the real colors. With the OLEDs, you get a much better image, much sharper image. You don't worry about refresh rate. I mean, I'm talking 240Hz refresh rate for a liquid crystal, which is darn good. But with the LEDs, you could have a refresh rate, you know, 1,000 frames per second if you were feeding it, and you wouldn't know the difference. Yeah, they have a certain amount of decay period, because these LEDs are, again, interesting. They're ultraviolet diodes that are exciting a phosphor. Similar to, you know, the LED streetlights, things of that nature. Let me let it drop. The process of manufacturing OLEDs has been a bit of a long one, and now they're starting to make big screens. So, yeah, they're a little more expensive. If you find a big screen OLED, or take a look at it and compare it to something else, you might decide you want to drop the extra $3. They're getting bigger because they're, you know, ironed out the manufacturing difficulties, and they get better. The TV sets with the curved screens, those are OLEDs. Well, there you go. K2RIW, K2J.
Darn good information. At least I'm being educated real fast on this, Eric. Most of us display our television screen and our handheld calculators in a quasi-dark living room. The most severe environment I can think of is a handheld device at high noon on Jones Beach, or I'm flying my airplane at 10,000 feet and that bright light is coming through the window and it's lighting up that screen. So under severe lighting conditions, do either of these display devices survive and still give you a good visibility display in that severe environment, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, if you're talking about doing displays outdoors at high noon, you know, you're asking for trouble. But, there actually are displays that are bright as all heck, and they look wonderful, but they're not the kind of devices you're going to go into Richard's mind, though. I mean, there's answers to that, but realistically, even when somebody's doing a shoot out in the middle of the sun, there's sunshade on the screen. It provides enough light and gives you enough image as long as you don't have the sun reflecting off of it.
So I better fashion the sunscreen. If I was foolish enough to take my large screen television display out into the backyard at high noon, I might not see much without a good sunshade, and that makes sense. I mean, the light from the environment is 10 dB louder. The light coming from my liquid crystal displays trying to light up the little pieces of phosphor, all those colors, all the little light-emitting diodes. OLED, organic LED. What is the organic part? I'd like to believe we don't have living material in there that's captured and is not allowed to get away. I presume it's an organic compound of some kind, something that used to be alive, so to speak, was one of the definitions of organic. So an OLED, is it the phosphor that's the organic compound? What makes the O of OLED, Eric? K-E2-E-J, K-2-L-A-W.
organic compounds don't have to come from living things to synthesize them. My favorite organic compound is butyric acid. The wonderful odor that it provides. That's actually an interesting molecule. But anyway, yeah. It's the light-emitting part that has the phosphorescence that you make.
So if I understand correctly, the part of an OLED that is organic is the phosphor itself that consists, in other words, it contains organic chemistry that gives you the various colors. In other words, your essentially ultraviolet light from the laser diode, I'll call it a laser diode, as it hits phosphor with various other compounds, it fluoresces. In other words, it takes the ultraviolet light and converts it down to some other visible light that's red, green, blue, and so on. So is it the chemistry in the phosphor that gives us the various colors? Is that where the organic comes from, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW. Can you give us a tiny bit more audio?
K2IW, KE2EJ. You know, what you're really asking me is what are the compounds that make up the phosphor? Right off the bat, I can't tell you, but that's where the name comes from, so. I don't think you could imagine a piece of silicon being very organic now, can you?
No, I cannot. And silicon is a real good material. Carbon graphene, carbon nanotubes, carbon organic is an interesting question. Just about everything that is capable of life has got carbon in there somewhere, because boy, that carbon molecule, he's got a zillion different ways he can combine with other things and make some very elaborate compounds. So could you make life out of silicon? I think it's a little bit doubtful. Almost all the life we know about heavily involved with carbon, obviously. So there's organic compounds in the phosphor giving us the various colors, and that's where the O of the OLED is coming from, is what I think I've heard. KE2EJ, KE2RIW, correct me if you like.
Yep, that's what we're saying. But, you know, carbon is a very, you know, one part of an important ingredient in something that's life. But, you know, we have animals on this earth, actually under the water, that actually don't live on oxygen. They synthesize the ATP and the energy that they need from hydrogen sulfide. There are these vents that are way, way down at the bottom of the ocean. I think you've seen them, tube worms and stuff like that. They've got all these really strange looking marine life. RWK to again.
So these extreme plants and animals at the bottom of the ocean near the vents are getting the source of energy. A very different food, so to speak. But still, I'd like to believe that plant or animal down there still has a lot of carbon as one of the major ingredients of his body. That's what I want to believe.
Oh, it is.
So carbon is heavily involved. So when it comes to living things, carbon is everywhere. Do you know of anything that you and I would call alive as a plant or an animal that has essentially no carbon in it, Eric? If you exclude carbon, have you essentially excluded life as we know it on planet Earth? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No, consider this. Here's a little food for thought. What happens when you lose weight? Where does the weight go? Something is coming off your body, and it's got to go somewhere.
An awful lot of what I call weight on my body is stored fatty material. My body is saying that in the past, my very early ancestors, one of the things that frequently killed them was starvation. So if you have methods of storing energy on your body, and you're about to have a long period of time in which there's no food available, and you can start burning those fats, start consuming that stored energy in the fat portions of my body, that I can get myself past this starvation period. So I think the body is continuously fighting what it thinks is the starvation about to come. And so with modern day availability of food, it's easy to overeat and therefore do overstorage, and we call it overweight. And a high percentage of the population is overweight, and I'm one of them. And as I look at the field day site, I see quite a number of guys with white hair. A certain percentage of them, a little bit overweight. We certainly don't look like a typical Oriental person as far as our weight is concerned. Let me drop.
Getting away from the point.
So, we lose the weight by the body taking that stored material, turning it back into energy to run the body, and so we're consuming those stored materials. Is that where the weight goes, Eric? Am I off on left field on this one? K2EJ, K2IW.
Well, what you just described is conventional thinking, but it's incorrect. That weight actually leaves your body in the form of carbon dioxide. You are exhaling carbon. Take trees, for example. Where does the bulk of the tree come from that makes it so big and makes it wood? Where does that come from? When you take the wood and you burn it, you're just left with carbon. And when you, before you burnt it, it was carbon and a lot of other stuff, right?
I heard a blast of noise. I think it was a human, but I'm not sure. But we'll go to you in a second, sir. One of the interesting puzzles you can ask somebody is that, hey, this tree out there is 5 tons of weight. Where did that mass come from of that tree? It started off as an acorn, and it grew into this great big tree. Where did all that stuff come from? Lots and lots of people think that, the minerals, the water picked up by the roots of the soil is where it came from. I think a very high percentage of that tree is carbon. Almost none of that carbon came from the soil. The tree doing its breathing of the carbon dioxide in the air, consuming the carbon, giving off the oxygen that makes us happy. So the majority of the mass of the tree came from the air around the tree. That's what I think you're saying. Correct me on that one, Eric. K2EJ, K2IW.
K2RY. Give that man another cigar. Now imagine a world without carbon. Would there be a world? And can take it from there, Dick.
Sounds like you've got some smarts on this one, David. KG2RY, K2RIW. Go ahead with your comment.
KG2RY, thank you. I guess the question I have is, there are lots of cultures all over the world that think differently than we do, and they don't see the world in terms of science or technology. They see it more in terms of spirit, energy, and perception. The tree exists as a collective perception. What do you have to say about that? Go ahead.
The philosophy now.
Yeah, this particular group is quasi-scientific in general. That's my guess as to the way we operate. And the philosophical, spiritual interpretation of the world, not many of us have used spirituality to explain radio, transmission lines, life, but there are a number of people who live the spiritual world as a major factor for their life goals, and they interpret the world that way. That's a very poor answer to what I think was your question, David, and quite possibly you're a more spiritual person than many of us. KG2RY, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
We can explore that. Well, there's things like radionics and some other stuff that you would think.
Yeah, extrasensory perception is sometimes involved, which is one of the conversations we got into today. Go ahead, David.
K2RIW, KG2RY, fine business. Yeah, well, I was at David's Werner Gallery a few months ago, and I look up on the walls, and it's an art gallery, a commercial art gallery, on the high end, the very best quality. And what they had on the wall was technical data, printout of technical data, different technical data printed out on paper, framed up really nicely. And so the technical data, was taken in a different context, and it had value as art. An artist can see that in technical data, but I wonder if any technically minded person sees any value in art at all. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm going to get an answer first, and I'm going to pass it over to who I think it was, Eric. 1978. I'm using a Hewlett Packard 9825 computer, and I'm studying my 16 Yagi array on 432. 19 elements each Yagi, 304 elements total. This antenna, you can see a picture of it by going to the LimeOcTechNet.com. You'll see me standing in the middle of this antenna system, 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep, on top of 100 feet of tower, and I'm standing in the middle of it for a size comparison. I wrote a computer program to make a three-dimensional plot of that antenna pattern. It looks like a bunch of very complicated mountains, so to speak, with so-called hidden line programming. Let me drop. In 1978, 10 megabytes of data was a huge amount of data. Just to record all of the calculations of all of that data to draw that picture, every third of a degree in azimuth and elevation, what was the exact amplitude of the antenna pattern out of that great big array of 304 element antenna. So I get this beautiful three-dimensional picture. An Airborne Instruments Laboratory is having an art exhibition within the building. And various people are showing things that they've painted, photographs they've taken, and I gave them a great big blow-up of one of these three-dimensional pictures. That, as I said, you can see on that website, LimeOcTechNet.com. I display as a piece of art, a very exact piece of science, of that antenna pattern, of the antenna I created by my own two hands. So, is there art in technology? Without a doubt. And you look at some of the things you can see under your microscope, and you take pictures of it. Boy, can you get beautiful things that really are art. And you take some of the pictures of what the Hubble Space Telescope has done with the right kind of video display. Let me drop. You take the, why can't I think of the name of the constellation with the three stars going through the belt, Orion. You take the right kind of a picture with the Hubble Space Telescope of the Orion Nebula, or little portions of it, the Horsehead Nebula, and so on. These really beautiful pictures of hard science of what astronomy is doing. Is that art? To me, it definitely is. So is there a relationship between art and science? If you know what to look at, if you appreciate it, yay, verily, that's my opinion. KE2EJ, I bet you you've seen some interesting science that really is art, Eric. You've got it, Eric.
K2RW, KE2EJ. Well, I'm not sure I got it the way before, but we were talking about chemistry, but from like the early 70s to the 80s, I look at it slightly differently than Dick does. I use the electronics as a tool to create art. In the early 70s, we had these things called scanning, other various types of effect generators, and we used that to make video work. And a lot of stuff of which I've made, actually, still playing in some museums in the other world. There were guys by the name of Manfred Tate that did his kind of art utilizing a red extra synthesizer, which is basically a CRT, stick waveforms into it. Colorization. Well, I've worked on lots and lots of things where the stuff that I do electronically facilitates creating life. So, you know, here you're talking about human beings and their perception and their ability to create what they see or hear, as opposed to what we're talking about, which is, you know, how does something physically happen? So, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we certainly have strayed quite a bit from your original question. But I can certainly see with all of the Bragg cell-like effects and metamaterial-like effects, I can certainly see how a magnetic field and an electrostatic field added to complex fluids can give you various birefringent-like phenomena where the polarization of a light wave or a radio wave traveling through that medium changes the magnetic field or the electric field. Polarization can easily take place on certain kinds of materials. I can see that. And there are ways where you can make a lot of use out of that. I think interferometry cancellation is used with LIGO in order to get that extreme sensitivity. They weren't using polarization, I don't think. But there are a number of science experiments. And by the way, radio astronomy uses a lot of polarization effects. When you're looking at the, I can't think of it, that man's name for the magnetic fields that you can see in free space by using a radio telescope to measure the polarization of the radio signal coming from various portions of a nebula that you're looking at. Let me drop it. Yeah, I think it's called the Zeeman effect. So by way of the Zeeman effect, you look at the polarization of the emissions of the radio signal with your radio telescope of various portions of, let's say, the Orion Nebula. That gives you a way of finding out what was the local magnetic field and what happened with that local star and its supernova and whatever to create those magnetic fields. So let me go back to you, Eric. I know we didn't get very deep into your original question. You're allowed to ask it as many times as you want to later on tonight or next Sunday and so on. KE2EJ to tie some ribbons on it, because maybe we should move on. K2RW, you got it, Eric. All
right, K2RW, K2EJ. On another subject, which will only take a second, but yeah, oh, by the way, the Zeeman effect is one of the things that helps make the cesium oscillators work, you know, the atomic clocks. I just did want to tell you from last week, the two, I cranked it up to actually where it would do full output, and there's no doubt in my mind that it's gassy and nasty, and I kind of back it up now. Until next time, it's P2RW, K3J.
Yeah, the tube you're talking about, I think, was a 4CX3500, external air-cooled, ceramic, very expensive broadcast transmitting tube. And by way of the crazy performance you were getting, I've seen things like that with tetro tubes, with my 4CX250B supplying parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432. When you got gas in the tube, the screen voltage, the screen current does some funny things, the control gate voltage and current does some funny things, the plate current does some funny things, it's got some crazy thermal time delay effects. So, and where your particular tube at your particular broadcast center that you're servicing had been a rebuilt tube, it certainly gives you a lot, and it was been rebuilt by a company that doesn't necessarily do Cadillac work, so I think there's a correlation there that the tube was defective. I'm guessing it was under original warranty, therefore you sent it back, and are they going to give you another one, or are you going to go to some other vendor to buy the standby tube for that situation, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I think I mentioned this before, but I'll say it again. This whole episode came about because there was some guy that does the regular maintenance that suggested that they do that. First of all, I'm not a believer in keeping ceramic tubes around because they have a tendency to outgas on themselves. And it's not a glass envelope. It's beryllium oxide, and as you well know, certain molecules pass through beryllium oxide over time. So I don't see the point of keeping a new tube on the shelf for 3 or 4 years before you're actually going to need it. Plus, in fact, they have standby transmitters, so if you blow a tube or it really gets soft, you go over to the standby, order a new tube, get it within the next week, and you're golden. So that's how the whole thing came about. Now, it's been supplied by a well-known broadcast tube company. It's being sent back, and they're asking for a refund.
The brand new price of that tube is roughly what, Eric? $30,000? Go ahead.
No, that tube's not that. A new tube like that from Iraq, and I think it's around $4,500. It's not that bad.
One of the most expensive tubes I've ever seen, made by Northrop Grumman during the B-1B program, a so-called Band-Aid pulse-up traveling wave tube, capable of pulsing up to a zillion watts of output at KU band, X band like frequencies. And I think that tube was in the vicinity of $110,000 per copy. That's a tube. This is a very elaborate pulse up traveling wave tube. Do any of your broadcast tubes come close to those kind of number of dollars, Eric? Can you top that? K2EJ, K2RIW?
No, I can tell you about transmitters. It's way more expensive than that. You know, transmitters are like $1 million, $1.5 million. But my
kilowatt transmitters, 30 kilowatt tubes. Those tubes went for like 27,000 feet. So, see, the 4CX24,000, I think that was only like about 11,000 bucks. The bigger the power, the more you're going to pay. Right.
Of those very expensive broadcast tubes that you're now mentioning to us, Eric, some of the high quality ones, if you treat that tube with tender loving care, megabytes of data. And by the way, those three-dimensional mountain pictures of my antenna pattern in 1978, I had to store it on 10 separate cassette tape drives. And when I played that data calculated back through the machine to make an XY plot, it would easily wear out a felt-tip pen before you went to the third of the picture. I had to adapt the XY Hewlett-Packard plotter to accept a repetigraph pen so I wouldn't be making a smeary picture for the last half of it. I had to go through hell to make those pictures. But tell us about arty science pictures, so to speak, Eric. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-I-W.
K-2-I-W, K-2-E-J. Well, the Library of Congress and many, many universities around the world actually have done quite a number of studies on various masterworks of art, discovering what the compositions of the pigments were, how the painters created them, the historical value into the particular piece of art. They x-rayed them. They do all sorts of things to document and best guess at, from what's not written about that particular artist, and what their view of the world is, and the things that they were trying to say, which of course, as you say, art is in the eye of the beholder. But there is an entire art world that is a merge of the scientific and art community. So yeah, a lot of data is extracted from pieces of art. And if you go modern day, then that's a whole other game. But here we're talking historical and things that are being well documented that happened at this point. New discoveries happening all the time in that world. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, David, KG2RY, K2RW in the TechNet. You're one of those very lucky guys living in Manhattan, New York City. And there's all kinds of great museums in New York City you can go to see all kinds of artwork. Some of it scientific and some of it much less scientific. So you're in the right place with your enthusiasm for that subject, David. KG2RY, K2RW in TechNet. I bet you visit a number of those museums from time to time.
Roger, Roger, Dick. K2RIW, KG2RY. Well, the reason why I'm asking is because I'm interested to write a proposal for curatorialship of photography, and maybe if it would be all right, you know, if I could ask you a question or two over the email, you know, over time when I have questions to ask, because I think you would be an authority, you know, on science versus art.
I appreciate your opinion, David. You might be disappointed to find that I'm not very spiritual. To some degree, I'm not very art conscious. I had put a man year of effort. I'm teaching myself a whole art and science called hidden line programming techniques, and I had to get deep into the theory of how a phased array antenna with 304 elements, where each element has a different voltage and a different amplitude of signal and different phase angle, to teach myself how to come up with a computer program that could plot that antenna pattern. I wanted to see with my eyes, in a way that I could understand, what was the antenna pattern out of that thing that I had created. So it took me a man year, during portions of the time that I'm pursuing this crazy goal. My goodness, did I run into a time warp problem on a couple of occasions. Let me drop. I had a passion to make that three-dimensional picture. I knew it would be exciting when I finally did it, from my point of view. On a couple of occasions at 4:30 at night, I'd call my wife saying, I'm going to spend another hour or two cleaning up this computer program. Then I'm going to stop over to George House, give him a copy of the first plot, because he was producing the antennas themselves. W2KRM was producing the RIW Yankees at the time. So I spent an hour in front of the machine cleaning up some of the program. I went to George's house, knocked on the door. He took a long time to come to the door. He came in his robe. I found out that what I thought was an hour in front of the machine where I'm studying the computer program and cleaning up the data, I had really been there 5 or 6 hours. I'm knocking on his door at midnight, and I thought it was 8 o'clock at night. And I suddenly realized what the radio program I wanted to listen to wasn't there while driving to his house. The time warp phenomena, being in front of a computer program, which you're really excited about. And so that three-dimensional picture, which I presented as art, but as you can see, I focused on that particular thing that I was involved in, and I wanted to have a quantitative, pretty display of what that antenna pattern was. A crazy passion, but people do things like that. Excessive compulsive people do things like that. But I've never picked up a paintbrush. I've done some arty things with a camera from time to time, but I'm far from an art expert. Ask away, but you may be displeased with on the general subject of art versus science. I might not be the right person, David. Over to you, KG2RY, K2RIW, Stecknet.
K2RIW, KG2RY. Fine business. First of all, I want to say that this artwork that you created in 1978 is a very valuable piece of art. And I know that somebody's probably going to recognize it. If not...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The effort, what went into it, and also the artwork itself. So, you never know who might want to pick that up as an artwork. Maybe not as a technical artwork, but as an artwork. What was the other part I wanted to say? Oh, you would be okay for me, and I'll tell you why. You'd be more of the technical side of it, and the technical side is what I really don't have much of, I'm more creative person. I went through liberal arts school. My family wanted me to go to technical school, but I decided not to. So I went to art school, liberal arts school, and I got a ham radio license anyway. Go figure. K2RIW, KG2RY.
Yeah, you go to a field day site. I went to three separate field day sites this weekend. Talked to a whole lot of people. And a whole lot of these people saw me face to face for the first time in a year. And they had piled up some interesting questions and challenged the daylights out of us. One particular guy I talked to for two solid hours at Gizbark, starting at around 2 a.m., ending at 4 a.m., and we're wondering why the sky was getting so light. We hadn't even realized what time it was and so on. I was telling him about in the college I went to, when you're studying it all night long for a great big final exam, one of our theories was you had to change your socks every time the sun came up. So passion sometimes is really interesting, the way people get driven. So, ham radio operators, a very interesting group of people who are basically a scientist hidden inside that body, trying to get out, using radio as one of the mediums by which they get out. And the nice thing about, ham radio, I mean, there are a few people who just love collecting cards. Hello, goodbye, you're 5'9 in New York, send me a card. But when you finally get a real medium of communication, be it Morse code, voice, or whatever, packet, and you're talking to a human being in some other foreign nation, you have a golden opportunity. You can ask the guy, I don't know what it's like in your particular town in Russia that's far away from Moscow. When you go to work in the morning and you open up the front door and you look out, tell me what you see. And that's just one of the crazy questions you can ask. The connections between very disparate human beings on planet Earth that can be brought together and talk to each other in a very beneficial way, by way of ham radio. The price is right. You start off with an immediate kinship between you and him. You both go through the process of getting a license. You get licensed in your particular country with your equivalent of the FCC. And you've had a little bit of fighting with the neighbors to put up the right antenna and the right, and build or buy the right transmitter and receiver and get on the air and do the radio equivalent of fishing. You call CQ and you don't know if you're going to get an answer from Japan or from Jericho, Long Island. You don't know, in some cases, where the answer is going to come from. And you have the ability to now enter into a real conversation with that human being. That's one of the things I really liked about, let me drop it. About 432 megacycles in 1970. That was far from an appliance 1968, 1970. You had to build the transmitter, build the exciter, build the receiver, build the antenna, put it together, make it all work. And as soon as you start talking to somebody, and you find a guy like Dr. Reed Fisher, K2CQH, who is one of the major inventors, from my point of view, of the concept called cell phone. And he and I are picking each other's brain as to how radio really works, what can it do. And he rapidly discovered that the cell phone concept has a huge possible history. And so he was there at a very pivotal time, from my point of view. He's a 432 operator, and I'm talking to him. I have a card file of 450 people that I talked to on 432 in that time frame. I kept track of each guy's signal strength, day I talked to him, what equipment he was using. And quite often those guys would say, "Hey, Dick, I just raised my antenna from the 40-foot level to the 60-foot level. How many microvolts am I giving you now? Write that down in your card so I can see what improvement I made." Again, lots of people would call me back like that. 450 people, 432, 10 states, locally, and all using homebrew equipment. That was a group of people where you could really get into a conversation, technical, philosophical, what do you like, whatever you like, and pick each other's brain for a half hour or 3 hours at a time, depending on what you and he wanted to do. Let me drop. And one of those guys I ran to was Al, K4CAW, Greensboro, North Carolina, on 432. This is 1978. He's got 100 feet of tower and four very good Yagis and a kilowatt of power on sideband on 432. I've got my 16 Yagis. I'm in the process of building this computer program to look at the antenna pattern. We're 480 miles apart. My radio horizon on 432 is 40 miles out from my 300-foot land at 100-foot high tower. I'm good for 40 miles line of sight. He's 480 miles away. 10 times my radio horizon. Every Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock, we talk to each other on sideband, 432 voice. 90% copy back and forth. We just couldn't believe a signal would get that far. How the hell did it get there? And that's another whole study in itself. And so, as you can tell, really picking each other's brain, comparing technical notes, if you've got the right kind of passion. Al, K4CAW, is now a silent key, and I, we did that for 4.5 years. We just couldn't believe, summer, winter, spring, and fall, that signal would go that far. Very different characteristics, summer, winter, spring, and fall, with and without rain, snowfall, airplanes flying in between, whatever. There's a whole story there that I should write someday. By way of, let me drop it. By way of an article that appeared in CQ magazine called The Magic of Radio, I think it is, appeared a few years ago, and I displayed some of these pictures. And by the way, those three-dimensional antenna patterns, really beautiful, mountainous-like pictures. When you operate that phased array in the low, medium, and high gain mode, you get very different pictures of that three-dimensional antenna pattern. And so, to me, that's arty science, beautiful-looking stuff, technical data, hard, real data, telling you a lot of information about how the antenna works, why that signal got so far, why he was able to hear me 480 miles away. And lots of people on each end, his end and my end, people were saying, "Now these guys are doing a hoax. They're really on the telephone." Let me drop quick. For a couple of years, Al and I were being accused of doing a hoax. We were really on the telephone. We really weren't talking to each other. Pretty soon there was a guy near Washington, D.C., midway on a mountain, aiming his antenna down to the south when Al was talking, up to the north when I was talking, and he started telling everybody, "Hey, these guys are really doing it. This is not a hoax. That signal is really there, and I'm hearing it." So, to go from a lot of significant people saying that you guys are charlatans, and all of a sudden we became quasi-heroes, that was a fun episode. Okay, once again, I divert. We've kept John waiting an awful long time, but he's a patient guy. Those guys in Jericho, New York, they know what radio is really like. KD2, IXP, K2RXW. Go ahead, John. Okay, we ran for Don late. We put him to sleep also. Sorry about that. KC2WGB, our mailbag expert, our chat room expert, and so on. Guy who's keeping his finger on what's going on in the background of all of this equipment, John. What kind of challenging questions have we got from our mailbag this week? KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Just want to leave a little pause in case Richie was dying out there. Now, we have two, actually, transmission line questions this week. Have here, and one of them is rather interesting. Maybe you can help this gentleman out. Let it drop, and I'll go on to the description. Okay, this gentleman's running VHF, and he runs up as high as 200 watts. And when he runs at 200 watts, he has a 12-foot cable from the rig which goes to a bullet connector to connect to an antenna that runs outside. Well, he notices when he's at 200 watts, bullet connector gets warm. Thought maybe there was a poor connection, so he replaced the bullet connector. It's brand new. And he noticed that one of the PL259s gets extremely hot. After 20 minutes of operation, he can barely hold it in his hand. So he'd like to know, he's taken it apart, the PL259. He looked at the braid and the pin. He cannot find a thing wrong with that connection. Maybe help him out. What should he look for, and what do you think is going on there, Dick? Back to you, KC2WGB.
There are lots of ham radio operators talking about connectors at VHF and UHF frequencies, and they come up with numbers that each connector is going to have a dB of loss. Absolutely, positively not. The only thing that has loss is something that has lossy materials or something that has real length to it. A coaxial cable, 50 or 100 feet long, has a lot of length, and it's got a small number of dB per 100 feet, and therefore it's got real loss. Most of the connectors we use are a half inch, three quarters of an inch long. They have essentially no mechanism for loss. However, I for one put them, because PL259, lots of people used to say they get half a dB of loss, I put a male to male and a female to female and a male, a pair of cables together, and sent 700 watts through that at 432 megacycles from the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 10 solid minutes. I put 700 watts through a mated set of PL259 SO239 connectors. And after 10 minutes, it got mildly warm to the touch. And you go through the calculation, it's 0.01 or 0.02 dB of insertion loss, very little. However, PL259, let me drop. PL259 is such an extremely popular connector. There may be 40 brands out there. And some of them look good, but they really are brand X because of the materials used inside. If you study coaxial cables, you can do this by Marino's book, Microwave Transmission Line Theory or something like that is the name of the book, by Theodore Marino, real good paperback book, 1950. He was working at Sperry Gyroscope at the time when he wrote that book. Very good book. Anyhow, you look in there and you find out that coaxial cable that is 70 ohms characteristic impedance, airline, has the minimum loss. 90 ohms or something like that has the highest Q as a resonator. And 35 ohms has the highest power handling capability. Well, the internal dimensions of a PL259 just happen to be a half inch of 35 ohm cable. 35 ohm cable can take the maximum power. It's got a nice big center conductor making good contact. So if you buy the right brand of PL259 made out of not inexpensive dielectric materials, but good dielectric materials making good silver-plated contact, you'll get an almost unmeasurable amount of loss of a well-made PL259. So that PL259 that he's got that's running hot at 200 watts at VHF. Let me drop. Assuming it's got good brand of coax cable properly put onto the connector, but the heat he's getting, I think, is a less than ideal connector brand name or installation. And by the way, there's a bit of an art and science to doing a good job of putting a PL259 connector on the end of a coax cable. From my point of view, the right way to do it is to trim the cable ready to accept the connector, then to tin the braid of the connector before you put the nut on first, but before putting the body of the connector on, you tin the braid first. that gives you the ability to make all those fibers of the outer conductor well connected by way of solder and ready to accept when you then, with a good strong pair of pliers, put the body of the PL-259 on the end of your cable. Now, with a good hot iron through those four holes, you can do a real good job of tack soldering. If you didn't tin the braid first, and now you try to, with a reasonable soldering iron, go through those four holes and pour enough solder in there without melting the dielectric and getting enough solder to get all of those braids making contact, very, very difficult. You got to tin it first. So if you tin the cable first and you put on the connector, you've now got a much better electrical connection and mechanical connection. So there's a bit of an art in science, doing a good job of putting a PL-259 on the end of a good quality piece of cable. Good job. So if I didn't tin the cable first, and I did a mediocre job, and I didn't want to melt down the cable, so to speak, of soldering through the four holes, and now I'm only picking up 50% or 30% of the braid strands in my soldering, of the way the connector is on the end of the cable, and the rest of the strands are going nowhere, so to speak, I can get a lot of extra ohmic loss at the end of that cable, right where the PL-259 is attached. So, is it a quality connector? Was it a quality installation job on the end of the cable? Was the female-to-female bulletin a quality connector, not made out of lossy, cheap dielectric materials? Was the contacts silver-plated, in good shape, nice spring contacts? There's a lot of variables involved. But when all of that is put together right, that so-called UHF connector, PL-259, SO-239, with enough understanding of what's going on inside, I would trust that connector to the kilowatt level at 1,000 megahertz if you've done a good installation. Yes, it's going to give you a little bit of Biswa bump, easily corrected with the way you do things. Let me drop. When it comes to bang for the dollar, that is an extremely good connector. It's been around for, let's say, 1940s, 60s, 75 years. That connector's been around for a good 75 years. Lots of people say nasty things about that connector. It doesn't deserve any of that slack if it's done right. So it's a good connector, and so with a little bit more research, I think you're going to find out where the heat is coming from. But at the 200-watt level, an amount of heat that you can barely hold your hand onto, which means the connector is coming up to 50, 60 degrees centigrade. It's not a very high temperature. It's not destructive. If you go on and kept using it that way, no further damage is going to take place, in my opinion. But you could lower that amount of loss and lower that amount of heat with proper connection of good PL-259 UHF connectors. That's my opinion on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I concur. I love the PL-259s. I've never really had any problems with it. I think he's going to find, when he cuts that connector off, which is what I recommend, we know it's not the barrel because he replaced it, and it is making a good contact. You know, he checked the friction on the pin, and he has no instrumentation other than a DMM, and he's not detecting any shorts or opens, but, you know, that really doesn't mean much. When I don't know if he pulled and applied stress to the braid to see if it was really soldered, but I think you're right. I think if he cuts it back and puts a new connector on, and not one of those cheap connectors that has the plastic inserts, if he gets an Amphenol connector or something like that, I think he'll do fine, and I think he'll have no more problems, because at 200 watts, that connector, it might be slightly warm, but it should not be hot enough to really have difficulty holding your hand, in my opinion. All right, I'll just drop one to the next one. Okay, this young ham has an Astron power supply. He's had it for about maybe 10 years. He's running a 70-watt radio on it, and here's his problem. When he starts off using it, he has 13.7 volts, and as he transmits, if he transmits for like 10 or 15 minutes, it drops down to 11.6 slowly, but then his radio does not perform properly. Now, so what he did was, again, he only has a small digital multimeter. He measured the AC voltage, and he has 0.3 of a volt AC, 13.7. It drops down to 11.6. He's measuring